oh man, I have to think of an entry again.
Yeah.
You're still paying for this, right?
I'm still. Thanks for gracious and generous.
You're recording. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Table for Two Podcast, where KYT prints out long notes, and my notes just say, troll KYT, troll KYT. You know, Warren, shout out to Warren for having printed out my secret notes, you know? I mean, realistically, we all know that I don't have any notes, but...
Yeah.
This is the podcast about a couple friends chilling and talking about deep magic strategy, not just your day-to-day stuff, you know?
It's so ironic, though. We're probably one of the most casual, in terms of the tone, podcast, but we also probably discuss higher level strategy than every other cast out there.
Wow, it's incredibly arrogant for you to say that. Like, I can say that. I understand what high level strategy is, but you have no idea.
Discuss. I'm not saying teach. Discuss is a fair word.
Okay, fine.
So I do want to talk sometimes, like, if I do this episode or future episodes, I know you're not a super expert on social media, but I think I love this as a platform for me to either rant or talk about that stuff and have you as being, you know, the Mr. Intellectual, like, I respect your knowledge in a lot of aspects of the world. So it's always nice to pick your brain on stuff like that. Man, Medina's gifted us multiple coffees at ko-fly.com/table-for-2.
Yeah, cheers. We just had some delicious ramen.
Yeah.
And now I'm enjoying... Here, just listen. A lovely sip of this lovely coffee.
Yeah. So thanks to everyone who buys us a coffee at $3 or two for both of us. That's, like, super awesome. And... One of them had a question that made me think that our content is a lot of it, even if you go to episode one, there's a lot of timeless content, and then there's stuff that people wanted to know, like, what did we think about the Yuya ban? And I asked you about it, I think it was episode two or three, when you dived into your thoughts about it. So there's a lot of good content from the beginning, I think.
Yeah, hope so. I mean... I really think of each episode more in along with the meal that you purchased me for it. This one was red curry seafood ramen. That's pretty good.
I know we recommend people to go to... I mean, okay, Ryan O'Quinn, probably one of the sweetest tweets that we've gotten. He tweeted out, I don't have a top five list, but I wanted to share by far my two favorite MTG podcasts that I consider required in all caps listening if you want to be constantly improving at competitive magic. Hashtag Table for Two Podcast with Insane Hayden and KYT Magic and Arena Deckcast with Jerry T and Brian Go. Table for Two will help you improve your game on a macro level. Actually, I'm not going to go through, but thanks for the shout out. And
what,
of course,
will you cut it off right before the bad part?
No.
I'm kidding. And thank you, Ryan. Yeah, appreciate it. And he had it in the right order, too. You know?
Right, in the right order. And shout outs, obviously, to our friends at Arena Deckcast. We love Jerry and Brian.
Oh, yeah, they're great. I agree with them. I think that they're for, like, the micro stuff, you know, that's who you should be paying attention to. So that's a good resource to up your game.
So I just want to talk about today, what I wanted to say, like, we deal with higher level strategy, but today you got to cast Fandom Legends tournament. How'd it go?
It was fun. I mean, I think it's now the fifth time I've casted one of their events. This is the first time though I did the top eight, and it's a little different in some ways, but you get to see it. And I'll say that, you know, Feel the Dead, that card was looking really good. I'm pretty impressed.
Do they choose who casts? Because I was always, when you told me about this, I always expected you, obviously, to cast the finals. But, like, you always casted the first couple rounds before giving the baton to two other casters, right? Do they choose? And
well, basically, we sign up. I mean, the first time they needed some people, and Siggy and I signed up. Mainly, it was, I think, Siggy who brought me in. Thought it'd be fun to do together, and it was. And they needed us for the Swiss rounds, and we kept kind of doing there, partly for the timing. Like, often I would go and want to have dinner after.
Oh, right.
And then today, we were meeting later, so I could do the top eight. It's good. And yeah, so it's fun. I've been casting with a bunch of today. With the Asian Avenger.
First time.
First time working with him. Yeah. Last week I did with Semulin, your buddy Travis Sowers. And but before that, I just did it with Siggy, and it's fun. It's very interesting because you get a different perspective when you do commentary on Magic, because you get to see what plays the players make, you know, while you have perfect information,
and
they don't. So it's, you know, it's easy to see what the right play is, also what is the right play from their perspective, and you can kind of compare how often those things are actually the same, and maybe you get a better perspective. I haven't done it enough to really know. You know, but in theory, if I get a large enough sample size, maybe I can discover like a fault in my thinking where I would normally do this in this spot, but it seems like from the sample size of seeing both sides, they actually have this card way more often than I think they would, or they have it way less often than I think they would, you know, based. So you can learn something there from just watching Magic. And I watch a lot of Magic, I'd say, compared to how much I play. With streaming, I've been playing more, but certainly for like PT testing in the past, a lot of my role would often be watching two people play and asking questions of why they did this and, you know, observing how I felt the matchup was and stuff.
So you just
learn from that.
Worked with like Siggy, obviously chemistry from your friendship, but did you just jump in and talk with Travis for the first time on the stream and the Asian Avenger as well?
Well, I already knew Travis. I'd given him some advice about tilting, and, you know, I think the advice was, he'd see me like flipping coins for $20 or something, and I was like, I'm just trying to build up tolerance to the variance, you know. And he like thought that was mind blowing, which, you know, I wouldn't quite go so far myself, but I would say that, you know, like people think, oh, it's crazy, these people are crazy, they're flipping coins for $100. It's like, you know, last paper tabletop Mythic Championship, I played a match of Magic where, like, I don't know what was on the line. My average EV was like $50,000 or something absurd, right? Because of how valuable first place was. And it's just, not that I was guaranteed first, just getting to play for that, you know? And like, so what is losing $100 on a coin flip compared to losing one match of Magic for $50,000? Or, you know, losing one match, you know, before playing matches of Magic for large amounts of money, even like just a late round in a PT where you're like, you have four losses or something, you're still playing for $3,000 that one match of Magic. We kind of separate that from the game sometimes itself. Like, I know my second Pro Tour, Worlds in San Francisco 2011, going into the last round, I knew I locked up my goal, which was to get to like kind of silver status so I'd get a PT invite, and I would have to have top eighted to get more than that. So I was like, didn't really try my last round. And then I looked at the payout difference if I had won my last round, which I didn't really, which I maybe could have if I like really tried. And it was like $1,800 difference, which for me at the time was infinite money. And so, yeah, so there's something to be said about getting rid of like the worry in your head, even if it's not conscious, that it's subconscious, that you don't really care about these. You're just, you know, desensitized to it. It's like when I would play in local tournaments and I would always split the finals, and then I would always, and played PTQs and I would always lose in the finals. And it's like, what's happening? Why am I losing? I think I'm a better player than a lot of these people. Well, in the local tournaments, I stopped splitting in finals and I'd play. And then I'm accustomed to playing and accustomed to being in that scenario where there's a lot on the line, because first place was like a mox and second place was like 10 packs or whatever, you know? And then I went and I managed to qualify for the PT, and since then I've actually had a pretty high win rate in top eights. You know, how much of that is variance, how much of that is known deck list versus the decks I like to play, etc. But I definitely feel calmer than I think a lot of people do in the feature match area, and compared to how I used to. I remember Barcelona, I was very, very calm, but the World Magic Cup, I was pretty nervous one of my feature matches there. And I think it was one of those games where, like, it all slipped away and you didn't really know how. And I think it was a game, you know, that if I'd been calm and collected and focused on just playing my best, that I could have won. But instead, my nerves got to me. So, Yeah, I mean, you know, we talked before in a previous episode, right, about people, like, showing emotion and tilting off and, like, how, you know, chess players, too, are known for being relatively stoic. But I remember finding a funny story from Kasparov's book, I forget what it was, where there was one of the players, like, after losing, you know, a long endgame, you know, shook his opponent's hand, of course, then walked out of the building and outside let out a blood-curdling scream. That was how it's described, a blood-curdling scream. And people are shocked, you know. But that's kind of the release of emotion that you often have, you know. People don't get to be this good at Magic without caring about it a lot. There's a lot of other things you could devote your time to. So, you know, it's even if people look like they're calm because they're, like, de-sideboarding after having won the Mythic Championship or something, they're just kind of in tournament mode. They have that as their coping mechanism to deal with the stress.
Man, this is the challenge of this show sometimes. Well, of this conversation. It's like there's so many...
You have so many notes, and then I just go off topic.
Yeah, now at this point, there's just like five different choose-your-adventure paths that I can take it. But let's wrap it with what with the Asian Avenger. First time...
First time casting with him, yeah.
Just talking to him, or no?
No, I got to interact a bunch with him at both the Mythic Invitational, and then he was also at the Tabletop Mythic Championship. He was in my draft pod, actually, for that. For my first draft pod, where he was passing to me in... I think I was passing to him two out of the three packs, and he was passing me in one of them. And he went 0-3, I believe, and I went 3-0. So, both of us with a Liliana on our deck.
But there's not much of a like discussion of how you just have a conversation about the game. There's no, like, you know, maybe I'm the expert and you're the, like, this show we have this chemistry where I'm the noob, you're the expert, so we have this awesome comedic chemistry.
That's normally how I expect when I'm doing commentary to, well, not the noob, but usually, you know, there's the classic sports. I'm not a big watcher of sports, but I know from people having told me that there's usually, you know, there's one person who's the color commentator who, interestingly enough, is the one who actually provides the analysis. And then there's the play-by-play who's, you know, the talk person.
Like,
in Magic, you know, Marshall Sutcliffe is classic play-by-play person, and let's say LSV would be, you know, the color and the analyst. So I normally think of myself as I would be in the analyst role, right? Most of the time, I know more about the game, I think, than whoever I'm partnered with. With Siggy, it was interesting because we kind of both are more suited to the analyst role. So we would kind of take turns doing the play-by-play stuff. But working with Travis, for example, he was perfectly professional, and, you know, he was doing the play-by-play stuff and let me do the...
He did my job just as well as I do it?
Oh, better. He's just got a perfect broadcasting voice. But with Asian Avenger, we didn't know each other as well, so it was kind of a little bit of both from each side. I ended up doing a lot of the, like, promotional stuff, like, you know, hyping their sponsor and announcing giveaway winners and so on, which, you know, with Travis, for instance, he would do all of that, and I would just be there to talk about deck lists. But it's a different style, you know, and you just kind of learn how to interact with the different people. And it's a pleasure, you know. Everybody has something to teach you when it comes to Magic, no matter how bad you think they are. Like, you taught me that, you know, networking was really important. And that people make really bad plays all the time.
Yeah, I think... Okay, that... We people don't know this because the footage was never released, but we did... The first time we ever did coverage together, well, the only time we ever did coverage together was at an auto event called the, I think it was part of the Kyle Ricks...
CMT or something? Canadian Magic Tour?
Canadian Magic Tour. When he was trying his own, I guess, brand of tournaments, and there was this awesome tournament at... I feel like it was
Hockey
like a...
Stadium, right?
Yeah. It was like one of the sweetest locations you could have for a tournament. We streamed it, and I think I would have, if I looked back, I probably would have regretted, if I remembered what type of commentary we did. I think we probably
I think you and I were fine. You and Rob Anderson, though, were a bit brutal. You kind of, especially to our poor friend, Robert Babadiscupi. He got brutally beat down for, you know, some suboptimal plays, but come on.
Yeah, it was rough, but it was obviously to me and you probably like hilarious at the time, but I think now we would make an interesting duo if we did coverage now, but that Ottawa footage
never
got released.
Are you using interesting, the classic magic interesting? If, you know, the translation. If I made a magic dictionary and you looked up the word interesting, the definition would be bad, horrible, but you don't want to be mean and say that it's horrible to your face. It's like, oh, what do you think of my deck, Alex? It's a really interesting idea. I really think the mana base particularly is interesting. But that's code.
Okay.
It's polite bad.
I'll continue from...
From your notes, yeah, I see them.
I have too many notes.
How many
notes.
Pages do you have?
One. But
this is a really thick page.
Yeah, it's nice quality and it's in color.
Good card stock.
But Bashir from MTGO reminds me of let's bang out some mental magic. Well, not mental magic, the game, the variant, but the mental game of magic, because you talked about how you had to strengthen. You mentioned last episode and this episode. Strengthen you playing when all the chips are on the line by not splitting as much in the local scene. And from Bashir, he said, I find whenever I'm doing well in MTG, I begin to expect to win and start playing a lot worse. I feel bad when I lose and start to tilt. Then after losing, tilting a bunch, I begin to expect to lose. Here I find I play really well and I don't have any regret if I lose, so I don't tilt. But as my confidence grows, I get cocky again and the cycle repeats. Does anyone else experience this? How do you maintain a mentality of expecting to lose to keep yourself playing sharp and not tilting? Avoid this cocky attitude that makes you play sloppy and tilt. TLDR is how to not enter autopilot when you get confident, sorta.
First of all, don't get cocky, kid. All right? But really, it is a challenge. I know that challenge of going into autopilot. In some ways, that's why I've actually noticed that I have worse results sometimes when I playtest too much. When I'm too prepared in a format, especially a constructed format, with one deck, I just, like, go into autopilot all the time, and I think that your autopilot is often incredibly flawed. And I think a lot of people just follow their autopilot, and I think it's one of the biggest mistakes that, like, mid-level Magic players make. And you have to somehow figure a way to force yourself out of the autopilot. One piece of advice I give is usually when you're autopiloting, you're playing really quickly. People who tend to like tank for it and take forever, they're the people who are like thinking through everything probably too much, right? They don't have enough of an autopilot. They're not prepared enough. But if you're doing everything too quickly, then it's not a problem if you slow down a little bit. So I recommend that basically before making a play, if the board state's complicated at all, just make yourself take like 2 extra seconds before you make it. You figure out your play and then take 2 seconds.
Just take a little bit longer.
Yeah, just take a little bit longer. Yeah, just go a little bit slower. No, but like, you know, double check your work. You know, if you're filling out a math test, you don't just put in the first thing, you know, and then just hand it in, right? Half an hour when it's a 3-hour test. You have 3 hours, you know, you're not going to take the full 3 hours because you can do it in half an hour, but you'll still look over your answers, make sure that they're correct. And it's the same principle that I want you to go over when you're playing Magic, that, you know, you found this play with your autopilot. You know, obviously, you don't have to, like, most of the time, your autopilot is easy because the plays are obvious, you know. Like, turn one, I'm going to play a mountain, I'm going to play my one drop, I'm going to attack. But, like, if there's anything, you know, slightly more complex, I want to take 2 more seconds, be like, is this actually the best play? And just see, is there any other plays? Am I missing anything else? And, you know, because if everybody's had that experience, right, where you make a play and then right away you slap yourself in the head, you're like, damn it, like, that's horrible because of this. Done it in chess, I've done it in Magic, you know, and everybody, I'm sure, has experienced that. You know, you catch it right away. Like, so obviously, there's many misplays that you're going to make that you're not going to notice. But you might as well, the ones you're going to notice, you might as well notice them before you make them, right? And if you take, like, 2 more extra seconds, you can do that. Again, I'm not advocating slow play. If you're a slow player, you're probably already thinking about things a lot, too much. But, like, 2 seconds more on each play, in like a somewhat complicated state, that's not slow play. That's just, you know, making sure that you're not screwing it up.
So have you felt that you've gone into autopilot, how he has gone into it? He says he's like gone on a winning streak, so it gets to his head where I guess he becomes so cocky and confident he doesn't take those 2 seconds anymore.
Yeah, I don't know. For me, like, it's weird because my approach when I play Match Magic, I always just assume I'm going to win until proven otherwise.
Okay, so
you're
starting from the cocky standpoint.
Yeah, a little bit. Like, you know, walking to a Magic tournament, it's like it's a lion walking to a den full of sheep, you know?
Even at the Mythic Championship?
Even at the Mythic Championship, yeah. I mean, there's some other lions there, you know? Or wolves, let's say, but...
Okay, but even at your first Pro Tour Top 8?
My first Pro Tour Top 8?
Did you walk in there and think you were the lion?
No, I was scared out of my mind. So much so that I'm sitting down next to John, across from John, right? And we're like waiting because there's so much downtime. And I'm just so nervous. And he's like making, you know, we're just like, it's just quiet. I'm like, I look him into his eyes. I'm like, I will destroy you. He's like, maybe. I've been destroyed many times before. I'm like, God damn it, John's too good. He's too good. His mental game is just there. He just doesn't
care. This is a true story, right?
This is a true story, yeah. Yes. I'm not making this up yet. Oh, there's so much random like chatter of like, you know, John's like
before.
Good, is, you know, like when we're doing our top 8 photos, John's like looking over the deck list, he's like, hey, is your deck even good? And then we're leaving, I'm like, good luck tomorrow, John, you're gonna need it. But yeah, so we had some banter, and then I kind of needed it a little bit to psych myself up, because I mean, it was, you know, not only am I playing my first top 8 or whatever, but it's against the greatest Magic player of all time. I didn't start with an easy one, you know? But then after that, I kind of felt like...
The lion, I love it. I love this analogy.
You love the lion? Lion in the room, sheep. Well, so, I mean, I think there's a difference between confidence and overconfidence, right? Like, I feel I'm going to go in, but if I lose, I analyze why, and, you know... Sometimes it's because I screwed up. Sometimes it's because, you know, Magic has variance in it. And I don't believe I deserve to win every time. I just think that, you know, I go into a match, and if I don't go into a match with thinking the most likely outcome is for me to win, then I'm just deluding myself. Because I think, for the most part, that is the most likely outcome. I, you know, there are some players who I can play, and I think that's not the most likely outcome. But... I still want to believe that that's the most likely outcome. I still want to try and find those wins out of nowhere because, you know, and claw and scrape and try and get them. I can't feel that it's owed to me. It's that it's not served on a platter. You know, I still have to hunt down those sheep and find them. And sometimes they fight back, you know? They fight back. Every day you go sit down and play a match of Magic, and you have to prove that you're the better player in that match. It doesn't matter what you've done before. It matters only that match. And sometimes my opponent is the better player in that match. You know, and then I'll try and get my revenge another time, but... So I have a certain amount, but yeah, they're going on a big winning streak. I can see how that can lead to, like, overconfidence. Where, like, you know, let's say you look at your opening hand and it's, like, kind of loose. And you know you really should mulligan. Deep down, you know you should mulligan. But you're running so hot, you've been winning so much, you're like... Why would I mulligan? I'm going to get there. I'm all good. And then you just keep it. And then you lose. That's what you got to avoid. You got to avoid that. And, you know, just try and keep yourself a little more grounded. I mean, try and play against someone better than you and get beat up a bunch, you know, or play a bad matchup a bunch. You know, sometimes you'll still win, and then it'll make be even worse. But you got to control how you feel about things. And really... You know, every match, you just got to earn it once again. Doesn't matter if you won your last 10 matches. This is a new match.
So, one of the comments was it. Well, another story. I paid for X rounds. It's something that our mutual friend Frankie Richard has popularized in the local scene, where he will play, like, oftentimes a lot of us will just X2 drops at PTQs or now MCQs or PPTQs, whatever, because usually it's like top 8, only top 8 has prizes, and oftentimes you can't even win prizes with an early 0-2 start, and the ultimate prize is to win, to qualify for the Pro Tour or the Mythic Championship. But Frankie popularized it by, like, he actually plays every round that he pays for. So I was like, I came here, and, like, if you're in his car and you want to leave, he'll be like, I paid for 8 rounds, and he's going to play them.
Yeah, well, I know Reed Duke has a similar methodology that he, you know, he wants to play every round at these pro-level events, even if he's in out of contention, off, you know. It's like, you don't get that many opportunities to play Magic against other prepared opponents who are trying to win, and, you know, at that level. Like, how many times do you actually get to play pro matches of Magic on like a Mythic Championship pro tour? You know, I've been playing on the Pro Tour for now, it's like 7 years, right? I played every single one, and it's still like, there's been 30 or so that I've participated in. It's still only like, you know, 500 matches of Magic or something less. And like that, you know, every match is still a relatively rare thing compared to, like, you if you're just jamming games on Magic Online or an Arena or with your friends at the kitchen table. So Frankie's attitude of, like, wanting to go and, you know, he played for this many rounds, he's going to play this many rounds. It makes sense to me. I mean, the thing is, it makes more and more sense the higher up in the hierarchy you're going, because the harder it is to find those events. You know, there's FNMs are relatively replaceable, right? Whereas, you know, World Championships, those I've, you know, played a couple dozen rounds of. Each round is just so much more value to play, and, you know, also there you used to get a pro point for every match win, so it was pretty valuable to just always play anyways. But I definitely understand the idea of not dropping. On the other hand, a lot of the people who are sticking around and still playing are often the less prepared opponents. So
I'm actually glad that you're... I was going to go there. Man, I just love... If only one of us could do the Frankie impression, because how he says it is just too funny. But I was gonna go there with this, and you got there before I was gonna lead you to it, which was, I don't think it's the same thing as playing in a situation where all the marbles, like, everything's on the line, versus training yourself to care when the stakes are low against an opponent who may or might not care either way anymore, right? Or is not as prepared. So,
yeah, I mean, one thing about me, certainly, that, like, if I'm playing a game of Magic against you, I'm going to be trying to win. It doesn't matter if we're playing, like, a game of Commander at our table, we're playing, like, a random playtest game, we're playing, like, mental Magic at the side game, or whatever, you know, game and testing, I'm going to be trying to win. And, like, otherwise, I just don't find it that interesting, because, like, I understand the people whose appeal is, like, playing Commander, and they want to go and have fun, and that's why I don't usually play with those people, because I'm going to make them have a bad time, and I don't want them to have a bad time. But for me, like, the interesting thing in Magic is trying to find, you know, thread the needle and find the way to win games, especially games that are very difficult to win. And so I still get value out of playing some of these matches, you know. On the other hand, there's the emotional toil that, like, if you're 0-3 in a tournament, you feel like crap. You don't really want to just keep pushing yourself there. But on the other hand, you know, I have a very good record when I have a bad record, I should say. Like, I think after LSV, I have the second highest win rate after a certain number of sample on day 2 of the Pro Tour, which means, you know, often I haven't had a great record at that point, and other people are starting to, like, give up. They don't care as much, and I'm still there. I'm still trying. And I think it is important to learn that skill as well as the skill to be able to give it that extra 10% or whatever when everything's on the line. And, you know, it's... I think, really, ideally, you should just be giving your all every time you play for, you know, small amounts of stakes, high amounts of stakes. You know, you don't have to be giving it if there's no stakes. You can screw around, that's fine. But I think it's if you're not prepared for those scenarios, you know, the emotions of both high pressure, high stakes, and low pressure, and, like, not feeling like you shouldn't really care that much, you need to still be playing Magic the same and same high level in both of those. One big discussion I remember having, I forget who it was, when I was coming up as a pro. I was like, look, I can see these top players, and like, I see them, I see when they play and how good they are, and like, I think at my peak, I'm sometimes better than them. The thing is, like, that they're, my ceiling might have been higher than a lot of these people, but my floor was also much lower. They were very, their like range of how differently they would play was fairly small. When they'd play at their best or their worst, it wasn't necessarily that different, you know? Like, let's say their best was at 98% and their worst was 95%. Whereas me, my best was 99%, but my worst was 80%. That's a big swing. And so most of the time they're playing, you know, in the high 90s, whereas me, I'm only playing in the high 90s half the time or a quarter of the time. So a lot of the work I went in was to try and increase my floor rather than work on my ceiling, because I think that was a lot of the problem I had. And it's a hard problem to do in some ways. A lot of it, though, involves working on kind of stupid mistakes that a lot of people, you know, wouldn't necessarily make. Working on, you know, just kind of solid little building blocks, which is why I kind of stress the fundamentals, because I think if your fundamentals are good, you can get a relatively high floor. And I think often that's more important than the ceiling.
At the end of the day, to finish up this segment, like, because, let's say, the local MCQs, people shouldn't, like, I think you agree, they don't have to play all nine rounds, right?
No.
It's pretty replaceable, like you said, and I mean, if you don't get a chance to play Paper Magic much, then I recommend you, and you have the time, but, like...
I would recommend, if you have something else you're going to go and do with your day, and you're out, you can just drop, but... Otherwise, I would consider playing when you're still alive for any prizes, because then you're going to play against other people who usually the reason they're staying in is because they're also alive for prizes and they're trying to win. And everybody's prepared. And there's something to be said for testing yourself and testing your deck in a tournament environment versus, like, you know, often the inbred environment of your test group.
Right.
Or, you know, the lopsided environment of Magic Online or Arena, where, you know, sometimes things are also ahead of time. And you don't necessarily control for your opponent as well. People might just not be trying, or they might get interrupted because they have a pizza getting delivered, whatever. So I think those matches are valuable, but if you're like 0-4 or 0-5 or something, just like, you know, if you want to keep playing, go. By all means, match is a fun game, but if you want to drop and draft with your friends or go and like go home and watch a TV show and eat some ice cream and cry, you know, go ahead.
Right. So I think we both agree it's not like a thing that you should
do or die.
Yeah, it's not do or die. It's not something that you necessarily are recommended to do to improve your MTG skills. Like I dropped at the Ottawa MCQ because I knew I was just gonna jam a bunch. So online at home, I ended up like the rest of the week playing a lot of White Weenie, testing it leading up to the Arena Super Cup, and I won that, and I don't.
Interesting that we come back to you winning the Arena Super Cup again.
I think we're going to have so many callbacks to that.
I mean, yeah, everybody has a tournament they won. For me, you know, I talk about the Pro Tour a lot. For you, the Arena Super Cup.
It's pretty good.
Yours is more recent, so it kind of holds a bit more sway.
So we had a friend of ours that I'm going to keep nameless because I don't know if they
Jonathan
actually want...
Medina?
No, I mean...
Advice on not being a noob?
I just typed that. I replaced this tweet. But this person...
Jonathan, whenever you start thinking that you're being a noob, stop that and do the opposite. Okay? You know, you can write... I know you have the wristband, like, you know, what would Jesus do? And then take that one off, put on one, what would Alex do?
Yeah.
When you're playing a match of Magic, you know?
I love it. So, I don't know. Like, this is a unique scenario. The question they wanted to ask us was, how do you deal with nerves and letting people down? And I think they were talking about specifically, like, a team tournament, team format. And maybe you have experience with that, but it's going to be tough because I think sometimes it comes from a place where they are, like, the weakest player of their team, or they might feel that way.
Yeah, right? I mean, team tournaments are both the best kind of tournaments because it's super fun to play with your friends. There's a lot more social aspect of Magic, like the gathering, which is something I really enjoy. And, you know, I the feeling of like winning with your team or like pulling through one tight match or even not even playing it, but your teammate gets it, and like after doing some sick play, it just feels so good, and you have other people to share that kind of emotional high with.
Even on the other hand, our League of Legends wins. I feel
exactly,
like,
yeah,
I feel
yeah,
really
yeah.
hyped when we win.
Yeah, shout out to League of Legends. But like there's the lows as well, where like you end up costing your team the win, not like your team loses, because whenever your teammate loses, right, you're not hard on them. You're not like, oh, you stupid moron, you screwed up. You know, you don't.
Some people are assholes.
Yes. Well, I don't team with those people. Sorry, but like, so I think you shouldn't treat yourself like that either, which is often how you do kick yourself, right? You need to have some self-compassion. Be like, look, you know, you screwed up, and like your teammates, they get that, and it feel like, for instance, the last team GP I played, I don't know if I mentioned this in the cast, but that like in the last round, I realized I had a deck reg error partway through my first game, where I'd like for onto D sideboard because there's a card I had one copy of in my main deck.
I think we've talked about this.
Yeah, and I boarded another one, and then I drew the second copy, so I knew that something was wrong. I called a judge on myself, and the only fix was game loss, because it's unfixable because I didn't know which one of the two was a sideboarded one. And I felt, you know, in that spot, I felt horrible. Like, if I do that and it costs me my equity, I feel bad, but, like, you know, it's a stupid mistake and I forgive myself for it. But, like, I'm also costing my teammates their equity.
Right.
And, like, I mean, that feels really bad. But, you know, you have to think, what are your teammates? You team with these people. They're your friends. Like, why do they decide to team with you? They know that you're a flawed human being who's going to make mistakes, you know? They don't expect you to be a perfect Magic player. Unless John Finkel's listening and the question's from him, and he's the personal friend you're talking about. In which case, obviously, yeah. John, I'm sorry, but they expect you to bit better if you... But no, like... You know, their teammates are making mistakes, you're making mistakes, and I think if you're just honest about it and... You know, you say, sorry, you know, guys, girls, NBs, whatever, you know, I screwed up and, like, ended up costing us the thing. It sucks, but that's how it is. That's how it is in Magic. Everybody's been there, and, you know, individually, and if you play enough at team events, everybody's going to have that experience in teams, too. So, you know, the whole thing, important thing to remember is that you live and die as a team, and that, like... You know, everybody's going to make mistakes, and you just have to forgive them, and you have to forgive yourself. And that's kind of...
That's good. I love this.
How it is, yeah.
I love, like, that we can hear a player of your caliber basically, quote-unquote, stupid mistake at a team event.
You know? I mean, I made in-play mistakes, too. Like, I was teaming with wee damn boys, you know, Steve Rubin and Mike Sigrist, you know, both... Fantastic players, Steve, a fellow PT champion, and Siggy, a player of the year. And all three of us, okay, all three of us were playing one match, and we just found the, like, one of the three lines that possible, the worst possible one is the one we took. That is, our opponents could make a block and just kill us in the backswing. There's another line that we're like, we end up at parity, and another line above that we're like, unless our opponents top decked, we'd win. And no, we all three put our minds together and came up with this one, you know? Like, it happens. Like, I know an MPL member came up, you know, cast like a trumpet blast main phase, and when it was a lethal attack, cast trumpet blast in the top four of a team Grand Prix. Yeah.
Wow.
And their team ended up losing because trumpet blast is only attacking creatures. The creatures were not attacking yet.
Oh.
So, yeah. If you just attacked first, it would have been over.
All right.
So,
wow.
It's everybody makes mistakes, and that's why, you know, you can watch top eights of events and see things that you think are mistakes, and sometimes they are, you know. Sometimes there's, you don't understand why the players are making them, but sometimes they just are mistakes, frankly. And the commentators don't usually call out mistakes.
Right, right.
Cuz again, they're also not sure if they're mistakes or not sometimes, but people make mistakes. To err is human.
Yeah, a lot of players don't make...
Forgive Divine.
Until, like, was it Mahara? You talk about that example?
Yeah.
Where, and I've seen when Jerry won his PTA, he made one of those, like, obvious technical mistakes. So,
Yeah, so many people have. I made mistakes in the PTI one. Like, the whole thing is you gotta just accept that you made a mistake. Be honest about it with yourself, with your teammates, and you know, find the best thing you can do to move on. And the best thing is not just beating yourself up about it over and over again, because that doesn't accomplish anything. It's to realize you made a mistake. How can you, you know, make the better play from now, or how can you learn to not make the mistake in the future? That's it.
Man, I'm getting tired holding this phone in Esports Central, because
yeah, you got to work those biceps, bro. I'm giving you a workout.
Before we would do it at coffee places, so I could just put the phone down, but now I keep having to hold it because we're at Esports Central.
Yeah,
all caps.
We've got nice couches though here with game consoles. It's a pretty sweet place. They're opening up some Magic tournament soon. Hopefully that works out for them.
Shouts to Andrew
Saps.
Gordon. Andrew Gordon for replying to the picture I just posted and type, is that Esports Central in all caps? Clearly, I hope it's because he listens to the show.
Yeah, if you just recognize it here. Oh, is that them over there?
No. I think he's from Toronto or Ontario somewhere.
Not anymore. He lives here now.
Esports Central. Let's see if we can do a bit of that. So I brought up MTG Insider last time and said that, okay, even though, you know, probably a huge marketing thing, whatever, but there was some good content from it, like I said. So I'm thinking back to MTG Insider stuff because John Zhang, Final Nub, asked us to really, because his goal is to improve at Limited. I think one of his goals is to day two a limited GP or just make day two of a PT because he felt like the first Mythic was it, first Mythic Championship or first Pro Tour he played he failed at, and
I believe it was the Pro Tour where I think he played Mardu vehicles or Red Black vehicles, maybe. I think it was Red Black vehicles, and I think the one Wyatt Darby won, Pro Tour Dominaria, I believe.
So he wanted to know how we approached getting better at Limited, or talk about it. I just wanted to mention. Well, we had talked about how you went to the next level in like episode one or two of the show about how what.
I think I went to the next level a bit earlier than that, but.
But I to another level above that when Siggy or other people have taught you. You know, going a little bit bigger or playing less two drops in your deck, but I'm going to mention some of my path. So to see what you think of some of the things that I learned along the way. At some point, you know, to dominate pre-releases or in-store drafts, it was just really I was just printing out or memorizing LSV's ratings, his limited review, which was.
Don't do that. Don't try this at home, kids.
At the point, pretty good. His first impressions were pretty good, and that was. I don't remember from what time period, but that's what I use as a starting point a lot of the time.
What about Ben Stark's limited reviews?
Has he done limited reviews?
Well, I think he does some that he posts in his team group, or sometimes just on Facebook by accident. But shout out to Ben Stark. But yeah, I mean. That stuff is a good first step, I think. If you have no other resource available, you know, you basically get LSV's first view of things before he's played with the cards.
Right.
And, you know, that's a reasonable baseline because it's probably more accurate than your baseline unless you also have a good feel for Limited.
And often, while you're playing at the pre-release level, just that information is enough to give you a significant edge against people you're playing who are probably putting in, like, we're talking about, like, either Midnight pre-release or one of the first pre-releases, pseudo-dead cards in their deck, so you have a huge edge. But the reason I bring up MTG Insider is because they did come out with a PDF that, like I said on the last show, I feel like Chapin either collaborated with them or based his book off of, and they put a marketing spin on what they called the ultimate deck principle. And it was really just, I believe, what is pretty obvious now when it comes to archetypes, but it was basically you draft the deck and you try to make an ultimate deck and of an archetype, and you would just save the color combination. Let's say you're drafting a lot of blue-white flyers, and you would draft on Modo, and you would try to iterate over it and figure out what you like and save those decks and look at them. And now you would eventually figure out what are the best cards to be in that blue-white flyers deck.
Yeah, like I know Sam Black, for instance, approach he has had is that he often, a set comes out, and he looks at what he thinks the archetypes are, and he builds, like, sample draft decks. Like, you know, not doesn't draft, but just, like, makes decks where he's like, this is what I think is, like, this deck is supposed to look like, roughly, you know. Here's an uncommon for this deck, and, you know, two of this common, and one of these commons, or whatever. You know, an example, blue-white flyers, or whatever, you have, like, you know, four two-drops of, you know, these... One uncommon, one two of one common, one of one other one.
Whatever, right, right, you know? Right.
And then like these flyers, and just like, you know, with a couple pacifisms, an unsummon, whatever, you know, the type of thing. It's like, this is what it looks like. And then you ask other people, hey, what do you think of this? Like, do you think like it has too much of this card? It should have something else. Should it look different? And it says, well, you know, I think is this a very good version of the deck, or is this like an average version of the deck? And you get input, and kind of you can iterate it that way, kind of like, you know, when we talked about the Mark Anderson scale and people iterating that. But I think that's a very interesting way to approach things. And yeah, the idea of like finding the archetypes and drafting them, I think a lot of pro groups often draft a bunch and people post their pictures of their decks, often along with the records, and say like, you know, would you have played any of these cards from the sideboard? Like, what was wrong with this deck? What was right about it? This card was way better than I thought it would be in this archetype, etc. And you can learn a lot from that. So I think crowdsourcing things, especially for learning a new limited format quickly, pretty valuable. But in terms of getting better at limited in general, I think it's a huge amount of getting a lot large sample size. When I started to become okay at limited was when I'd basically go and money draft at my friend Yi Cheng's house, like, multiple times a week, and we'd be there, like, I'd go there at 9 p.m. and be there the whole night until, like, oh, look, it's 8 a.m., I gotta go to class.
That's actually happened before?
Yeah, multiple times. I would do this multiple times, yeah.
You wouldn't sleep, and you would
I
just,
wouldn't sleep, yeah, and then it's like, I go to class, yeah. I wasn't gonna skip class. Eventually I skipped class, but not then.
This is gold.
Oh, I mean, I would not be very useful for class because I'd be tired out of my mind. And then, you know, they'd be like, hey, you want to come back again tonight? I'm like, no, man, I can't. I need to sleep tonight. But then I would come another time. And I just would draft over and over and over again with people who were trying to win because there's money on the line. And at first I would lose. And then by the end, like, we'd pre-order boxes. And before we'd be, like, done the boxes we pre-ordered, he would order them, and I would owe him a share for them, and then before like we were halfway done, I would not owe any money for it anymore, and then he stopped inviting me to his thing. That's when I knew I made it, when he stopped inviting me, because he would only invite the people he thought were like fish.
Oh, right, yeah, that makes sense. That actually makes sense.
So it was, and I learned a lot. It was like very intense boot camp. It was, you know, Lorwyn draft format basically. So I still feel pretty comfortable in that format. And I know for a while some people thought of me as more of a limited player. I mean, my first GP top 8, right, my breakthrough there was in limited, and then like my PT top 8 I went 6-0 in limited, so a lot of people thought of me as limited guy. And
but how is this different from iterating then?
Well, it's because in constructed, when you play a ton of games, the games are almost all like the same,
right?
After a certain point, you're just doing the same thing over and over again. In limited, eventually you get to that point, but I don't think it's really possible before a format shifts over to actually get to the point where all the games are the same. Which is why you see these people who like someone like on Twitter, Dustin Stern, who drafts a ton and he always posts a bunch of stuff about it. He's drafting over and over and over and over and over again, and he never gets bored of it. And it's because he doesn't have the same game happen over and over again, because everybody's deck is always different, including yours. You only play 3 rounds with your deck before you switch to a new one. And then there's the whole draft portion, which is also always different. So I think there's a reason why a lot of pros love limited, is because of the fact that it's always so fresh.
But are you saying that there's more to learn per match in limited than constructed? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think so. I think limited is kind of about testing your skills on the fly more than constructed, which is testing your preparation.
Okay.
And I think limited, often in constructed there's more strategic understanding than tactical. In limited, a lot of the fights that matter are tactical. And by that I mean in constructed, you really need to know, like, you know, I'm the mono red deck, this is how I need to be approaching the matchup, and, like, you know, or in a control mirror, like, knowing, you know, how to play out the game, how your deck functions, basically. Whereas in limited, like, that's important too, to a certain extent, in that, you know, you need to figure out how you're ultimately going to win the game, which is when we talked about, like, Siggy loves to draft for inevitability. That's usually how he plans to win the game, that if you just put his deck face up versus opponent's deck, his cards will trump their cards. That's the plan. But often limited games are much more on the tactical level, where both of you have just kind of a mid-range pile of things, and you're just figuring out how to, like, you know, trade your, like, two cards for two slightly better cards or whatever from your opponent, and then, you know, maneuver so you use your mana a little bit more efficiently here and there and stuff. And that's kind of always a little bit more different, and it's a different type of understanding, because I think you need to figure out each single tactical situation, whereas the strategic stuff, you kind of either understand it deeply or you don't. Like, you know what you should be doing, you have an end game in mind, or you don't.
You talked about what Sam Black does. You talked about what you used to do, which is, like, grind. Well, not grind, but play a crap ton of drafts, no sleeping, and go to class. Well, what do you do now?
What I do now? I mean, what I've done, I've increased the amount of drafting that I do as preparation by a significant amount of how much I did in previous years when I wasn't winning very much at limited. A lot of that was started by drafting Magic Online, drafting on Arena, but also, like, the last set, drafting in person again, because that was all that was available. But it's one thing I noticed is that actually drafting on Magic Online was made me do better in day one drafts at the PT level, whereas before I would do better on day two drafts, because I was used to practicing in-house drafts where the level of opposition was higher and people kind of had more of an understanding of what cards were signals and which weren't.
Okay, I got you.
So I think that's one of the things you do need to learn through repetition, of, like, you need to understand not only the cards and how the games are played, but also other people's evaluations of the cards. You have to figure out that, you know, if this card comes fifth pick, even if you don't think it's that good, that's a signal this color is open. And vice versa, hey, this other card comes fifth pick, you think that's a huge signal this color is open, but it's actually not, because nobody else thinks it's good. Like, let's say in War of the Spark, like Spellkeeper Weird or whatever, the red 2/2 that whenever you cast a non-creature spell, we'll get a +1/+1 counter. That's a card that people who hadn't played the set that much might not value that highly, but people who had would realize this card is actually fantastic. It's really good, and it shouldn't be going that late. So, however, you know, if you get that card 6-pick at the PT, what does that mean? Does that mean red is open, or does it mean that people just don't know that card is good? And, you know, it's hard to figure that out without having actually played drafts against people around that level and kind of, you know, picked it, and then you find out, oh, it turns out red wasn't really open, someone passing me was red. And you don't want to find out that out the first time when you're drafting at the PT, right? You want to figure that out ahead of time. Whereas, like, when you do house drafts, things do get a little bit inbred at times too, and everybody ends up having similar card evaluations. So it's valuable to get kind of a mix of perspectives that preparing online does provide you there. But I already kind of have a good grasp of the fundamentals and how to approach situations both tactically and strategically. So for me, I usually need to just learn about a format. And so somewhere in the range of 10 to 15 drafts is what I like to get in for a pro tour. So I'm a bit behind on Modern Horizons. I think I've done about 5 of them now.
you talking about like day one draft quality reminds me of GP Ottawa. I've mentioned this story before, where I'm in a pod with Huey, and to my right was Kyle Hooper, now current fellow employee of His Face Games, and in his first pick, there were like three black in commons or decent cards, like probably like 8 or 9 out of 10, and he decides to take, I forget which pick, it was pick one or two or three, it was one first pick, he opts to pick Leaping Master, a 2/1 one red creature that you have to pay white to give it flying.
It's no Traveling Philosopher.
So yeah, the you know, there's no way you would pick, you would, there's no way you would pick that, just the upside, it's not even like a bomb card, it's a in its own right. So yeah, I can, that just reminded me of that, just a master leaper. And that's why Peter Sackless, at one point when the artist was at a GP Montreal or something, got her to sign like 20 of them, and he gave them to me. So shout out to Peter Sackless. So
I mean, I had a drafted recent GP Montreal, I guess, where, you know, the person passing to me pack one opened a pack with Niv-Mizzet and Crackling Drake in it, and passed both of them, took some other card, because, you know, didn't want to fight over Izzet. I'm like, oh, Niv-Mizzet, I'm going to take that card. Right. The person passing me is not Izzet. Well, the person I passed to was like, ooh, Crackling Drake third pick, better force Izzet.
Right.
Despite none of it coming in the later picks, you know. So that's like, you know, that pick, I would be in a much better spot. First of all, I would just never have seen the Niv-Mizzet, I guess, if it was drafting in, like, just my team. But, the next level is, like, I would take the Niv-Mizzet and the other person would, you know, not move in. But it turns out the first person was correct because of the level that other people were on. So it was, it's interesting, like, understanding your opponents is very valuable. Like, something to talk about in these draft evaluations of cards is that we're like, well, we think this card is better than this card, right?
Right, right.
So does that mean you should pick that card, card A that we think is better, versus, or card B, which other people think is better? Which one should you be picking higher? And the answer is not completely clear. You know, you could think it's clearly A. You want to take A, it's because you think it's the better card. It is the better card. At least in our reality, we thought it was the better card enough that we believed that it was the better card. But if you do that, then other people are going to see B later and think your color is open.
Right.
Versus if they see A later, they might not think that, and you might just get A, or you might just get A to wheel. And so there's the other side of that is also that you see some cards where, like, Siggy and I are discussing, it's like, well, we're just never going to have that card in my deck because I'm never going to take it as, I don't think it's as good as other people do by at all, so they're going to always take it highly, and so I'm never going to take it that highly, so someone else is going to have it in their deck instead. Example, let's say, is like Healer's Hawk, which is a good card in its draft format, but it's not, we didn't believe it was as good as some other people thought. Because, again, you know, drafting for inevitability, that's not the type of card you want. That's the type of card you want in a low-curve Boros deck where you either go 3-0 or you go 3.
Right.
And that card, obviously, you sometimes go 2-1 and 1-2.
Right.
I'm just saying, like, the draft either pays off and you force Boros and it works out and your mana works out and stuff and your deck's insane, or stuff goes wrong and your deck's bad. But other people were valuing the Healer's Hawk really highly, so they would take them, like, first pick or, like, third pick. Whereas we, like the Healer's Hawk, but it was, like, we valued it, like, fifth or sixth or something. So if we saw it sixth pick, take that Healer's Hawk. But we never were seeing it sixth pick because other people were taking it first.
Right.
Whereas some other cards, like Hypothesis Lore or whatever, if that's in the pack, we're slamming it. But other people, sometimes we get that seventh pick. It's like, what's going on, you know? And so, in some ways, you get rewarded for drafting differently from other people because you're not fighting over the same cards. And a lot of draft is figuring that out. Figuring out what is undervalued and to kind of get into that, you know. Not only in general, but also in your specific pod. Like, people talk about, you know, this right now, M20, everybody says, oh, white is the worst. Well, I figure that if everybody at the table believes that, nobody wants to touch white with a 10-foot pole. Well, I'll take all those pacifisms over here. You know, my deck's going to be nuts. I'll take it. It'll be nuts. Because draft is self-correcting in that way. It's, you know... Now, if there's a second person drafting white at the table, deck's probably not that nuts. It's probably, you know... But you get the point, though, that, you know... People's expectations are like that. For instance, Avacyn Restore draft, everybody hated it. And they all drafted the same way. They all thought blue-green was the best, and they tried to force that really hard. Whereas I was like, well, obviously, everybody else thinks that's the best, but it's never open. I loved drafting black, and I drafted black both times, with Homicidal Seclusion being, like, the MVP card, and crushed it. And I was crushing all our testing drafts, drafting often black control decks, too. Shout out to Pascal Maynard, I think, who brought me onto that in the first place. Because it was a little tricky to draft, so if you hadn't practiced it, you wouldn't necessarily know how to do it. But, so people were like, also thought black was the worst color because it kind of was only doing its own thing. It didn't really pair with what the other colors were trying to do. And then I just got like, you know, I first picked Homicidal Seclusion, got one third pick, and then got one eighth pick. I'm like, we're doing it. And we did do it.
Do you think if, like, let's say next week, you go and you sit at a pod with seven people you don't know, do you think, like, just knowing what people talk about, Twitter or talking to fellow pros or what's out there gives you a good idea what these seven people, let's say they're just from different countries that you probably know what their tendencies are?
Yeah, I figure they're going to lean towards whatever LSV's power rankings were, you know? That's the... or whatever.
Ben Stark?
Or Ben Stark's. Like, whatever they saw, their, you know, whatever the information out there from someone who's a reputable source. Because most people, frankly, don't have that many reps, especially often you come to the Pro Tour, you'd be surprised how few drafts most people have. A lot of people qualify playing Constructed and they don't really know draft. And, you know, that happens. Like, a lot of these mixed format tournaments are like that. Also, people spend a huge amount of time preparing for the Constructed portion and very small amount for the Limited portion, where I think it should be the other way around. But that's a topic for another day.
All right, well, this is cutting long, so I'll just wrap this up quickly. We have more thoughts for next time. So even though they put like the marketing spin on it, the ultimate deck principle,
ultimate deck principle.
I think I sort of used it to win my first PTQ when I was trading in draft, where a lot like in one of the forms, in multiple formats, this was like one of the better decks where you'd have like Nantuko Husk and Arc of Treason, like the Arc of Treason deck, Act of Treason deck was like the one of the best archetypes in a few different formats. And I think applying this, like, I mean, I wouldn't say ultimate deck, but just playing the archetype and realizing I just learned how many sac outlets I wanted, how many active treasons I wanted, like, and should I prioritize active treasons over other cards. So just iterating over a certain archetype is, I think, led to my success to qualifying for the first time.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, I think that's really important. That's one of the reasons why getting those reps in, to figure out how many of each things, like, you know, Modern Horizons, for example, there a lot of the draft archetypes are about enablers and payoffs, and like how many of each do you want and which one do you start drafting first. And I think it depends on the archetype. Some of them you want one, some of them you want the other, you know.
But you're not doing the Sam Black method, right? You don't have like the deck planned out
already,
right?
Yeah,
I haven't done that either, ever.
No, but
but hey, if it's worked for him, maybe it's worth the payoff.
You know, there's a lot of ways you can put in work and you can get benefits. You know, for me, I think the path of least resistance. I do the minimum amount of work to get, you know, to get
maximum result.
Yeah, I mean, it's more like I'm happy to put in 10 hours to get to 90% when a lot of other people, you know, they put in 20 hours to get to 90% and then they put in another 20 hours to get to 95%, you know? And that's fine. That's their approach. I think that, like, there's just so many things in Magic that you can improve on, that if you focus to start with on these things that have incredibly diminishing returns, you're wasting your time. And since it's, like, always a race against improving against versus other people improving, you need to find the things that make you improve the quickest and the most efficiently. or just, you know, quit your job and play 13 hours of Magic Online all day. You know, but I don't think that's a realistic approach for most people. In fact, I can't do that. Like, I need to take a break after I play for a few hours. You know, it's, there was a time where I could play Magic all night and then go to class in the morning, but I'm an old man now.
Legendary. This is a legendary story. All right, we'll call it. Thank you to everyone, and we'll talk to you. You'll hear from us next week. Bye.
I will not talk to you.
Please don't contact. True.
No, I'm kidding. If you have any questions or any shout-outs, send them to me and KYT. We love hearing your feedback on Twitter. The warm fuzzies warm our hearts. And again, as KYT likes to say, no matter how small your following, David Rude, Alan Wu, you know, no matter how few Twitter followers you have, you can make a difference.
But you can, and if you're going to put out a top list, always put us at the top, right?
Yeah, so you can have it, you know, in reverse, or say in reverse order or whatever. Just, we need to be the number one.
All right.
Number one.
All right, bye, guys.
Peace.